I'm not so sure. It's entirely possible she truly believes she's starring in her own reality show. I mean, he's clearly so not a nice person. I like your elbows, Jessica says. And I like your hair, Willow says. You ladies are all beautiful in my book, Gabriel says, though he is only looking at Willow, and I wonder if he has always been this patronizing. When did we decide that these people would be our friends? What if we took the time to get to know some of the kids in the other cliques, like the artsy types or the theater dorks? What if we all jumped out of our boxes and chewed up our stupid labels? Who would we discover? Gabriel's not going to ask Annie to the prom, I realize with a sick feeling, even though she is 10 times cooler than Willow and the rest of them. He'll be afraid she'll wear something outrageous, that she'll be too Annie. I try a different tactic. I sit down next to Justin, close, put a hand on his arm. Please, pretty please, tell me, I say. I just want to know. My tone reminds me of the kind of girl I've never been. Needling, faux cutesy, hyper flirty. I came here for one reason and one reason only, and I will not leave until I've fixed this for David. I feel like I owe him one, maybe because I abandoned him in the snow with his tape measure. Or maybe because I understand just how much this whole thing will suck for him. I know what it's like to walk down halls with your back the target of 1 million eyeballs, hearing the ripple of echoes you leave in your wake. Did you hear? Her dad died, her dad died, her dad died. Darling, we don't know what you're talking about, Justin says, and Jessica laughs, maybe at his condescending darling. I want to smack them both across the face, hard. Come on, I know you guys stole his notebook. My tone shifts again, back to anger. I consider standing up one more time. Seriously, chillax, Kit, Abby says. It's so not a big deal. We're not saying you're not pretty. I'm going to Principal Hawk. I barely even register Abby and her hybrid word and yet another unsolicited comment on my appearance. For a while there, when Justin and Jessica were hooking up, everyone called them Justica, and I would think every single time, I can't wait to go to college. I'll tell her I saw you take it. I look to Violet and Annie for backup here, though I'm not sure if I'll get it. They are not exactly on hashtag Team David. Why would you do that? Justin asks me. We're your friends. He sounds both surprised and hurt, like he'd never expect me to turn on him like that. I think back to what David said, about how the coincidence of landing in the same school at the same time wasn't enough for him to fit in here. Did Justin used to be my friend? I mean, for real? He came to my father's funeral. Told me he was sorry afterward, just like everyone else. And then he and Gabriel hung around the parking lot for a little bit, doing their headlock and tripping each other thing. I have sat with them more times than I can count in this very booth, gossiping and watching YouTube videos on each other's phones. But do we know each other at all? Have we ever had a real conversation? I don't think so. No one except David has asked me what I think about God, or an afterlife, whether I place my trust in science or religion. No one except David knows about the accident playing each night on my ceiling. I trusted him enough to tell him about my mother's betrayal. It would never occur to me to be honest with Gabriel and Justin, to lift that muzzle of self-consciousness and share, to let them see me cry. No, we are not friends. We are placeholders. But I was not as strong as David. I couldn't go it alone. I probably still can't. Because it's cruel. Because he is a good person. Because, I say, I wouldn't risk it, guys. If you get caught, that could really hurt your college applications, Violet says, and stands up as if to join me in my protest. I notice she's untucked her shirt, which makes me ache. Kit's right. Take it down, and if you don't, I'm going to tell on you guys, too, Annie says. And I see she's wearing a fitted denim jumpsuit over a tie-dyed peasant blouse and big 70s disco ball earrings. She looks ridiculous and so much like herself that I want to hug her. Now we are three strong. That was his private journal or whatever. Posting it wasn't cool. It was just a joke, Justin says. Now, I demand, and point to the computer. Seriously? It can't wait till I get home? It's not like taking it down does anything. Everyone's seen it already. Now, I say again, and for once, I actually sound tough. Maybe it's because I know Violet and Annie have my back, that my squad hasn't totally dissolved. Justin moves his fingers over the keyboard and poof. Just like that, the link is disabled. Too bad he's right. It doesn't really matter. The harm has already been done, and no doubt there are a zillion screenshots everywhere. Nothing ever really gets deleted from the internet. And give me the notebook. Again, to my surprise, he does. It has a plain blue cover and a spiral edge, and the name David Drucker written in small block print at the bottom. Charmingly retro, like something a fourth grader would carry. I'm tempted to flick it open and look at his drawings. I love how he made my neck look like something worth looking at. Honestly, Kit, I can't believe you'd pick shithead over us, Justin says, leaning over for a high five from Gabriel. Oh, man, that was classic, Gabriel says. Classic. A few minutes later, I'm standing outside with Violet and Annie. Thanks for defending me back there, I say, staring at my feet. You guys are the best. Yeah, well, Gabe asked Willow to the prom, so screw him, Annie says. And though she makes it sound like no big deal, I know it is. I'm sorry. That sucks. I wish I were more surprised by this information. I wish we could all see each other more clearly. David's right. He really does have a clown mouth. Violet says, bumping her elbow against Annie's. You don't really want to go to the prom with a guy who looks like the Joker. Annie doesn't laugh, just blinks a few times to suck back the water in her eyes. You don't want to go to prom with a jerk, I say. What he and Justin did was really wrong. Yeah, maybe. Still, there's some weird shit in that notebook, Annie says, fiddling with her giant earrings. Be careful around that guy, Kit. Come on, out of context, everyone's journal is weird, I say. Not sure why I feel the need to defend David, even to Violet and Annie. He's not mine to defend. But I didn't read the whole thing, just enough to get the gist. Really? Violet asks, her eyebrow cocked in surprise. It just didn't seem right. You should. Annie says. I shrug. Before everything with my dad, I didn't really understand the need for privacy, for the desire to be free of other people's questions. Now I do. What's the accident project? Violet asks in a voice that's soft, tentative, almost a lullaby, like she's asking something easy. Like, what's my favorite food or television show? Or if she can borrow my Spanish notes. Is that why you keep skipping classes and didn't go to the newspaper meeting? Because you are working on that? What? The accident project. What is it? Annie asks, with none of Violet's gentleness. We have almost all the same classes, so I know it's not for school. What are you doing with David? That's in there? I ask, wondering how much David has written down. Did he expose me to all of Mapleview? I try to remember how I've even framed the question for him. I want to know the exact last second my dad's accident could have been avoided, when the brakes needed to have been pressed, if the whole thing could have been stopped in the first place. I want to make mathematical sense out of the inexplicable. Now it just sounds insane. Like I said, you should read it. See who you're ditching us for, Annie says. So you're not going to tell us about the accident project? It's nothing, really, and I'm not ditching. Annie shakes her head at me, gives me the palm of her hand, and before I can finish speaking, she's already halfway toward her car. I turn to Violet. I'm not ditching you guys. It's not like that. She's just, you know, pissed about Gabe, Violet says. And we miss you. I'm sorry, I say. This hurts, I want to say. Even just standing here talking to you, it all hurts more than you could possibly imagine. I want to show her my watch, how time barely moves forward, how I don't much care for this version of me either. I stay quiet. Do you really like him? David, I mean, Violet asks, and her voice is hopeful, as if my liking him will excuse everything else, like the fact that I no longer want to hang out with her and Annie. I don't deserve her forgiveness or her understanding. If things were the other way around, if Violet suddenly ditched me for some random guy without much of an explanation, I'd have no sympathy. I don't know. He's really easy to talk to, I say. I like being around him. What I don't say, I can tell him things that I can't tell anyone else, like about my dad and my mom. Maybe one day about me. He weighs information honestly. What I don't say, he moves time forward. Violet nods, but she looks sad. You used to like being around us, too. It's bad enough that I get a guilt trip from Violet and Annie, but then a few minutes later, as I sit in my car and garner up the courage to put the keys in the ignition and head home, I get a text from my mom. Awesome. Mom, I know I'm not your favorite person right now, and my timing isn't great, but I really don't think you should hang out with David Drucker anymore. Me. Are you kidding me? Mom. Saw that Guide to Mapleview link. Annie's mom sent it to me. Me. How dare you? That was his private journal. Mom. I'm just worried about you. That's all. Me. Leave me alone. Mom. Sweetheart. What's the accident project? Me. Screw you.
Chapter 21. David. Pi doesn't work. Neither does the periodic table. I try simple counting, and I make it all the way to 300,000, but I cannot let any of it go. My notebook is in the public domain. Kit must have read the whole thing by now, even positing the assumptions that, one, she didn't see the link until after 4 p.m., which allots 35 minutes for a pit stop on her way home from our meeting, and two, that she reads at a painstakingly slow rate, a page every 5 minutes, which I realize makes no sense given her high PSAT scores. She would have made it all the way to the end at least an hour ago. Which means that it's all over. Us sitting together at lunch, the accident project, me being in any zone. The Venn diagram of our relationship has unvenned. I consider texting her, but I am too scared to turn on my phone. As soon as I got home, it started buzzing from numbers I don't recognize. You little shithead. I'm gonna kill you. How dare you say my GF looks like a Miss Piggy, Next time I see you, you are effin' dead. Die, retard. Weirdo turd. You're the pizza face. WTF is wrong with you? Do us all a favor and die. That's a recurring motif in the texts and also in the online comments. My classmates' desire for me to die, which seems disproportional to the crime, as it is obvious that I was not the one who published my diary. How can people be angry for things I never expected or wanted them to see? It's illogical. Like prosecuting someone for a thought crime. And they want me dead. For real. Like for my heart to stop beating, for my mother to lose a son and Miney to lose a brother, for me to no longer exist, at least in my current form. All that just because I filled a notebook with simple observations to help me remember people's names and who to trust and how to survive in this confusing world called high school. Joe Mangino, the captain of the football team, looks nothing like a Joe, but he does look a lot like a ferret and used to squeeze my nipples when he passed me in the hallways at school. Was it so wrong of me to write that down? To make a note to myself that when I saw a rodent-like meathead, I should get out of the way? Purple nurples hurt. I'm assuming that the threats to kill me are not literal. Miney used to threaten me all the time when we were little, and I don't believe she ever meant it. But I see no other way to interpret the desire for me to be dead. Maybe they do not want to do it by their own hands and actually murder me, which could risk them getting caught and going to jail, not to mention force them to cross certain universally agreed upon moral boundaries. But certainly, they want the same end result. For me to no longer be living. Do us all a favor and die. Kill yourself, you piece of shit. No, it gets even more specific. They don't just want me dead. They want me to commit suicide. Apparently, the best way I can contribute to this world is by leaving it. My hands are flapping again. Tears are running down my face. I am losing control, slipping into a vertiginous vortex. I used to think loneliness was being stuck with only the one voice in your head. I was wrong. Loneliness is hearing everyone else's voices too, except they are stuck on repeat. Die. 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 A knock on my door. Then it opens. I don't bother looking up, not sure I could even if I wanted to. I know it's Miney by the one-knuckled sound and the smell that follows. Her new sandalwood perfume and dirty hair. It's down, she says. The link, it's down. I thought you'd want to know. I don't say anything. Continue to rock, head to knees, my hands tucked in, so the flapping makes me swing forward and back. My mom must have gone to Principal Hawk after all. Too bad it's too late. Everyone who matters has seen it, and I'm sure it's cached on at least 100 hard drives. Kit will never talk to me again. Miney asks if she can rub my back. I shake my head no. Once. Hard. I can't quite make out words yet. Orange. The world is orange. Like the blazing center of a cartoon sun or a volcano. No touching, just oblivion. Give the people what they want, as the expression goes. Okay. I love you, you know. This will be okay. I promise, little D, she says, but it comes out all garbled. Instead, there is orange. And a sound like roaring, not soothing like the ocean, but loud, deafening, annihilating. I know this feels like the end of the world, and I've been there. Believe me, I've been there. But you will be okay. But in order to be okay, I need to be here. And I'm not. I'm floating away. The balloon inside my head is getting smaller and smaller until it disappears altogether into the blue sky. I don't go to school for the next 3 days. I stay in my room and fill the time with my flapping and with pie. I sleep too. Long, dark sleep that is neither restorative nor dream-filled. It is as close to dead as I can get without dying. Miney and my mom take turns checking on me, and sometimes they sit on my bed, a safe 2.5 feet away so we don't touch. But they rock with me, their rhythm matching mine, and I like it. The almost company. A tiny reminder that I am not alone, not completely. On what must be Tuesday afternoon, 1 day in, Trey knocks on the door. I do not stop rocking. I do not lift my head. There will be no guitar lesson today.
I'm here for you, buddy. Whenever you're ready, Trey says.
But I am not ready. Later I hear Trey and Miney in the hall. I try to pay attention, as if listening to their words and translating them into sentences I understand will help bring me back. You've done good work with him, Miney says, and I get stuck on that word, work. He'll be okay.
You think? Trey asks. I don't know. That was scary. Has this happened before, this bad?
Not really. Not like this.
I thought we were making progress.
I think about guitar riffs. Latch my brain onto the sequence of notes Trey taught me last week. He's been doing great. He made a friend. He's been cracking jokes. He seemed to be really connecting. Until now, Miney says. And then their words get softer. I can't tell if it's because they are moving farther down the hall, or if it's my brain closing back in. This will end soon, I realize, much later. I feel the despair seeping away. That's not true. The despair, that horrifying realization that I am not just disliked, but hated, and that I have managed to lose the only friend I've ever had. That feeling is not going anywhere. Still, I decide it's time to come back, and I feel my mind hardening around its edges, putting its tray tables and seats upright in preparation for landing. I swing my legs over the side of the bed and stand. I'm dizzy with hunger and greedily suck up the smoothie my mom has left on my desk. I shower, and when I go to wash my hair, I am shocked by how little there is. I had forgotten about my makeover. Afterward, when I open my closet and see that my mother must have gotten rid of my old shirts and khakis, I fight back the panic. I reach for my new clothes. If normal people can handle buttons and creases and hoods, so can I. When I walk downstairs, Miney and my mom are chatting quietly in the kitchen. My mom offers to make me my favorite sandwich or heat up chicken soup, as if I've been laid up with the flu. Miney's hair is back to its normal color, and she is not wearing pajamas. It occurs to me that this is the first time I've seen her dressed since she's been home. Something deep inside of me sighs at this realization, loosens up an invisible knot. I'm going to school today, I announce, too loud, I think. This is the first time I have spoken in 3 days, and I'm out of practice. I am going to school, and if anyone asks me to die, I will say, no, thank you, and keep walking. Or maybe I won't say anything at all. Either way, Gabriel and Justin are the ones who should be suffering, not me. I did nothing wrong. Not right now, my mom says, laying out an elaborate assortment of food in front of me, each item on a separate plate, just how I like it. I'm not scared, I say.
It's not that, little D. It's evening. School's closed,
Miney says, and she reaches over and touches my shoulder. She might be testing me. I don't flinch. I look out the window and see that the sky is turned dark and blue, a bruise. I want the world to be green again, like Kit's eyes. Eat, my mother says, and then we'll figure out what to do next. Her we sounds nice, not like the we of what are we going to do with you. This we implies that I am not alone, that we are all on Team David. I imagine us as a ragtag group of do-gooders on the side of the underdog and the wronged. Team David, in my imagination, looks a lot like the Bad News Bears. Okay, I say, and then I dig in, making my way clockwise from plate to plate. After a little while, I look up, and my mother and sister are still here, sitting and watching me eat.
Welcome home,
my mother says, her voice thick with surprise, like I had gone away to a place she thought I might never come back from. Later, Miney and I take a walk around the block. We bundle up in our winter coats and scarves and gloves like we used to when we were little, and my mother would send us out to play in the snow. I used to hate being forced outside and away from my books, into the wet and the cold. I remember the stinging flesh and the gap between my sleeve and my glove, how that one inch of exposed skin ruined everything. I never understood how Miney could keep on building snowmen and making snow angels with cold wrists. Now I don't mind it so much. I like the bulk of my coat, the way I feel buttoned into it, like getting tucked into bed.
Fresh air will do us good, Miney said.
I agreed, since I'm already off schedule. I have not practiced martial arts in 3 days, which is the longest break I've taken since I started training, and we are here, walking down the street. It looks like the rest of Mapleview has all gone in for the night. There are few cars. No one else is walking. I like your hair, I say, pointing to the spot that used to be purple.
I thought I needed a change and then realized that's not what I needed at all, she says.
I think about her words, weigh each one, the same way my mom squeezes fruit in the supermarket. But I don't come out the other side. I don't know what she means.
I'm proud of you, you know. School hasn't been great lately, and then something happened, nothing big or anything, but I know how you feel. I've been where you've been. Sort of.
You sat and rocked back and forth in your room reciting Pi for almost 70 hours straight? I ask.
Okay, not exactly where you've been, but the public humiliation part, totally. And honestly, I realized that if you were brave enough to go back to school and face all those jerks, then I can too. So thank you for that. But that also means I'm leaving soon. Consider this your first warning, she says.
Okay, I say. The old me would have cried or screamed or begged her to stay, but I'm not the old me anymore. Despite the events of the past 70 hours, I am growing up, getting stronger. I'm miles away from normal. I will never live in the same state as normal, nor do I necessarily want to.
but I'm getting a little closer. I'm a refugee on Normal's border. It will be okay when she goes. I will be okay. And I assume she will be too, because she's Miney. Just don't dye your hair again. I like to recognize you when you come home. She smiles at this and nudges me with her elbow. Both of our hands are in our pockets, so it becomes a game, our nudging. I doubt you actually humiliated yourself, I say.
I sort of did.
I don't ask how, because I know from personal experience that it's not fun to talk about the ways we've embarrassed ourselves. Then you have to feel it all over again in the retelling, and if Miney wanted me to know more, she would have told me. How long till you leave? I ask.
A week, maybe?
But I'll be back for spring break, and there's FaceTime. I nod. So I saw some of those texts you got.
I wish I could kick all those kids' asses.
I actually could, I say, and for a moment I let myself picture it. A series of palm heel strikes and the entire football team would be on their backs. I could kill them if I wanted to.
Please don't.
I laugh, because we both know I never would. When I was little, I used to get upset if I accidentally stepped on a bug. I may have mastered the art of self-defense, but I don't like to hurt things. And anyhow, despite how they all feel about me, I don't wish anyone dead. Not even Justin or Gabriel. Even if I believe the quantum theory that consciousness survives death, I don't want their bodies to go still forever. I wouldn't mind if they moved away, though. That would be nice.
What are you going to do at school tomorrow?
Miney asks. Same as always. Put on my headphones. Ignore them all.
And Kit?
I think about Kit's eyelashes, how the snow gathered and nestled between them, like it was a good place to rest. I think about her fingers linked with mine. I see her back as she ran away from me as fast as her legs would take her. I think about the contours of the word disgust, its guttural G.
I don't know, I say.
Chapter 22, Kit. After 3 days, David is back. He's sitting at our table, headphones on, eyes trained downward. When he was gone, I rejoined Annie and Violet at lunch. I listened to them brainstorm a new short list of guys who would be acceptable prom dates. I told Violet I liked her high-waisted jeans. I went to all my classes and to the newspaper meeting and then went home afterward and watched Netflix with a bowl of popcorn bigger than my head. I've eaten turkey and hummus on rye 2 times a day. I should win an Academy Award for Best Actress in a movie called Normal. No doubt I'd be the first half-Indian girl to win. In the evenings when my mom gets home from work, I've blasted my music in my room, the acoustic equivalent of a do not enter sign. I realize how much I've missed talking to David. I approach him slowly. I feel awkward, like we're strangers again, like this is no longer our table. Could be I don't know how to act around the only person in the whole wide world who would describe me as the prettiest girl in school. Not even my own mother would be so charitable.
Pretty doesn't just happen, Kit,
my mother likes to say. You have to try. Hey, I say, and sit down across from David. How are you holding up? He looks up, pops off his headphones. How did I forget about his great haircut and cool clothes? I may not be the prettiest girl in school, but there is no doubt he's a really cute guy. Of course, he's also the weirdest, which can make for some cognitive dissonance.
Not great, he says.
I have something for you. I slip the notebook out of my bag and slide it over. He makes no move to take it.
Did you read it? I notice that his eyes are on my clavicle, which is a part of my body I've never had occasion to think about until I met David. I resist the temptation to put my fingers on the freckles he drew. I considered ripping that page out, keeping it as a reminder that there was once someone who thought I was beautiful. But I realized it wasn't mine to take. Some, not all. I know I shouldn't have, but I got curious, and so I sort of flipped through. I'm sorry. I have caught David's honesty disease. I didn't need to tell him the truth. I should have just said, "Not really." That would have been close enough. Turns out, though definitely strange and random, there was nothing too disturbing. He didn't expose me. Instead, on a fresh sheet toward the back, there was a short list under the title Kit and Dee's Accident Project. Never talk about the AP at school. Library? Research car specs. Calc. Bad idea to help? Definition of friend zone? This last one made me laugh out loud. I figured. I wish he'd put the notebook away so we could pretend it never happened. I want us to go back to the way we used to be together, comfortable. I didn't know if you'd sit with me today, after everything. Well, you said only nice things about me. I mean it to sound like a joke, but it falls flat. There are, of course, a lot of people in this room he didn't say nice things about. I can't imagine what that must be like, knowing everyone in school has read exactly what you think of them. It's all very Harriet the Spy, except without the guaranteed children's book happy ending. Of course, I've had a million mean thoughts about my classmates, but they've mostly stayed safely locked inside my head. I excel at keeping things to myself. Another post-accident acquired skill. So, where have you been?
Home.
David's eyes meet mine.
Did I make you run away the other day? I don't know what I said.
You? No, it wasn't you. It was that place, I say. And he nods like he understands, and maybe he does, but then again, maybe he doesn't. It's hard to tell with him. Sometimes I think he is the only person who understands how to have an actual conversation with me these days. And then I think about his notebook, how different he is, and wonder if I've been imagining it all. If I've been so desperate for a real friend that I've created this other David in my mind who doesn't exist.
You're fast, you know,
he says, and for the first time since I sit down, he smiles. He looks even better this way, happy. I don't think I'm making him up. I really don't.
I mean, I've never seen anyone run that fast.
Yeah, well,
you talk to your mom?
He asks, and I shake my head.
You will, eventually, when you're ready.
His voice is certain, and I hang on to that, because whenever I think of talking to my mom, the tears bubble up fast and the words get clogged in my throat. I have been ignoring her knocks on my bedroom door, her text messages, her calls. I look up at David, trying not to cry. I've been holding everything back, boxing these feelings up, throwing a label on the outside, organized and sorted, like I can convince myself that they take up barely any space at all. Just a corner of a closet shelf. You know what actresses actually are? Really good liars. Before I have a chance to say anything, the entire football team approaches our table, a block of biceps and thick thighs, standing shoulder to shoulder. And then, like we are in a bad teen movie, Joe Mangino, a beefy guy with buck teeth, steps forward. He flips David's lunch tray. An empty milk container goes flying onto the floor. Are you serious? I ask, and stand up, though now that I'm on my feet, I have no idea what I can do in the face of all these muscles. These guys are big, and they are not my friends. I can't just ask them to stop like I did with Justin and Gabriel. Well, I can ask, but they're not going to listen.
Stay out of this, kid. This little shit needs to die,
Sammy Metz says, who looks like is a linebacker, a giant oak of a boy. He'd look good next to Willow. Don't you think that's extreme? David asks the question like he genuinely wants to know the answer. There isn't an ounce of fear in his voice. So calm and collected, it's borderline creepy. Suddenly, he seems less alien, more robot.
You want me to die?
I've spent almost 3 days thinking about it, and I still can't figure it out.
Not only do I want you to die,
Joe says,
I want it to hurt badly. I'm just deciding, should I shove my boot down your stupid throat, or should I feed you your own nuts?
You know, if you shove your boot in my face, it's unlikely to fit in my mouth. And I have no intention of eating my own testicles, David says, and then turns his head away as if he is no longer interested in the conversation, takes a bite of apple, then puts it back on its plate. We watch him, and when he looks up again, he seems surprised we are all still here.
What do you want? Everyone's watching. Obviously, you can't touch me right now. We're going to get you, Drucker. When you least expect it, we're going to get you,
Joe says, again with the horrible cliches. Is that what he does on weekends, watches bad movies and practices the resident jock's lines in front of a mirror? Step one, flip lunch tray. Step two, make scary but generic threats. Step three, take more steroids and grow even bigger breasts.
Move it along, gentlemen,
Mrs. Rabin says, approaching the table and ushering the football guys away. She doesn't ask David if he is okay, though. Instead, she glares at him and shakes her head. What's up with Mrs. Rabin? I ask.
What?
That look. What did you do to piss her off? David motions to his notebook. Uh-oh. I wince. Teachers, too?
Yep.
David shrugs up and down like he's being manipulated by an amateur puppeteer. His body language, I realize now, is as stilted as everything else about him. Hope this doesn't hurt my college recommendations. Later, in AP World History, Ms. Martell drones on about the impact of the Industrial Revolution. Blah, blah, manufacturing and steam engines and terrible factory conditions, blah, blah. I text David. We both have our laptops open so we can iMessage and look like we're just taking notes. He's sitting three rows over and one ahead. I guess he's been sitting there since September, and I study his profile. I like his lush eyelashes, and the slope of his cheeks, and the way he cocks his head to the side and stares out the window. Me. Are you scared? David.
Of what?
Me. The whole frickin' football team. David.
No. Do you know what I am scared of, though? Sentient artificial intelligence. And global warming. In equal measure.
Me. They could kill you.
David. I know. If we create machines that can learn to feel the whole range of human emotions, we are all dead. And I think we've long passed the tipping point in global warming. I expect apocalyptic weather will soon become the norm.
Me. I meant the football team. Maybe you should tell someone, like the principal?
David. Oh. On one hand, they've made it clear they want me dead. On the other, I doubt they actually want to do the dirty work. Not to mention they'd have to dispose of my body. And all their prior threatening texts could be used as evidence against them by the police. They're stupid, but not that stupid.
Me? Question mark?
David. I think it highly unlikely that they'll kill me.
Me? I didn't mean it literally. I meant they could mess you up.
David. Again, unlikely. Also, I know various forms of self-defense,
including but not limited to Kung Fu and Krav Maga. They should be scared of me.
Me? Really?
David. Yep. But you know what I don't understand?
Me.
Everything. David. That's a joke, right?
Me.
Yes, David, that was a joke.
David.
Right. So what I don't get is why everyone is mad at me, instead of realizing I'm the one who has been wronged here. Not a single person has come up to me and said, I'm really sorry this happened to you. Not one person.
Me.
I'm really sorry this happened to you.
David.
I'm being serious.
Me.
So am I.
David.
Thank you.
Me.
You're welcome. You really know Krav Maga?
David. Would I joke about something like that?
Chapter 23. David.
I thought college would be easier, Miney says on Tuesday morning. She is sitting in our breakfast nook, digging into a pile of pancakes. My dad is manning the stove with his headphones on, the same pair I have, though instead of listening to music, he prefers audiobooks. He claims it allows for efficient multitasking, but it has the unintended perk of allowing Miney and my mom to talk without him hearing. I'm just beyond the door, eavesdropping. I realize I don't actually have the power of invisibility, but I come pretty close. Like it would just be an extension of high school. But then I got there, and I had to make all new friends. And no one seemed to like me. Lar, of course people like you. My mom leans forward and squeezes Miney's hand. Miney is being ridiculous. Everyone likes her. That is one of life's constants. Like the chemical makeup of water.
It's not just that. As you know, Rush was a disaster. My classes are seriously hard. And there was this guy...
And? My mom asks.
And nothing. Well, not quite nothing. I really liked him, Mom, and I thought he was interested too. And so I saw him out one night, and I, like... basically threw myself at him in front of everyone, and he made it super clear he wasn't at all into me. It was beyond embarrassing. Plus, I don't really have any friends. Not real ones yet, anyway. It just feels like college is one rejection after another. Maybe I picked the wrong school, or maybe I'm just a big loser.
Who are you, and what have you done with my daughter? One guy doesn't like you and you come running home? My mom asks. He's obviously an idiot.
He's actually super smart, Mom. He was my physics tutor. I was the idiot.
Miney puts her head down on the table, and my mother strokes her hair like she's a small child. I think she might be crying, but I can't tell from here.
That's why you've been moping all this time?
Little D, you scared the crap out of me! Stop lurking! Miney screams when she notices me. Darn new clothes and their crinkly sounds. My khakis were much more inconspicuous.
I wasn't lurking, I was eavesdropping, I say, and step into the kitchen.
Stop it! Miney and my mom say at the exact same time, so I have no choice but to say, Jinx, a Coke! Though I don't drink caffeine.
Maybe we should talk about this later, my mom says, and Miney nods. I wonder what my dad will say when he finds out that Miney needed a physics tutor. Since last summer, he has been putting a lot of pressure on her about college. He's adamant that she major in something useful, like math or biology. Before she left, that's all he could talk about, how Miney needed to understand how much school was going to cost my parents, that she better finally figure out what she was good at, that she should stop wasting time putting on makeup and instead apply herself in the sciences,
like I did. Anyone can be prom queen, but not everyone has the opportunity or the capability to learn from Nobel Prize-winning geophysicists, he would say, and Miney would look him straight in the eye and say, I was homecoming queen, actually, and some parents would be proud of that. I stayed out of it, though it's not quite true that anyone can be homecoming queen or king. I certainly can't. Miney might not be the best person to talk to about quantum theory, but she's a genius in her own way. I just want to say I love you guys, and I'm so lucky to have the two bravest kids in the world. And sure, you both make mistakes, but please don't let anyone or anything ever make you feel small, okay? Either one of you, my mom says, and stands up and kisses both me and Miney on the tops of our heads as she makes her way to the sink. My mom likes pep talks. It's kind of her thing. Statistically speaking, it's unlikely we are the two bravest kids in the whole world, I say. Just say I love you too, Mom, my mom calls over her shoulder. And I have no idea how one can feel small. I assume I feel exactly proportional to my size. Miney kicks me under the breakfast table. I look up and she's glaring at me. I love you too, Mom, I say. I pull my car into my parking space at exactly 7:57 a.m., which gives me 1 minute to gather my backpack and head toward the school entrance. I'm back on schedule, which I realize in the aftermath of slipping over the edge last week is even more important than usual. I need to stay focused, follow my routine, find my peace in its rhythms and repetition. My playlist is ready to go, and so I slip on my headphones, as I always do when I exit the car, which is why I don't see them at first. The football team, lined up in the parking lot. A wall of solid meat. Could be a coincidence, I tell myself. They might not be waiting for me. But I free-ear it just in case I need all my sensory abilities.
Drucker!
Joe Mangino says. Or is it Sammy Metz? I can't tell them apart without my notebook. To me, they both look like the hanging slabs of an unidentifiable animal you'd find in an old-school butcher shop. Cold and pasty white where the fat is. This guy is more rodent-like than porcine.
We wanted to chat with you. Say hi.
Hi, I say, and then instantly regret it. A stupid reflex.
So it's no secret that we want to beat the shit out of you.
Meat Boy, that's the perfect name for him, Meat Boy says, and I find myself nodding along because he's right, it is no secret. Though I thought they wanted to do worse. I thought they wanted to kill me.
Don't worry, we're not going to do it here or right now. Just wanted to remind you, in case you had forgotten. Keep you on your toes.
I haven't forgotten, I say, and look up and spy Kit coming out of her car one row over. I wish she had been a few minutes early or late, which is something I've never before wished, since I like watching her walk into school each morning. Not strictly a necessity for my routine, because she's only on time about 3 out of 5 days, but like the lunch lady remembering to wear her hairnet, or when my phone switches to track 2 when I round the corner to my locker. It means good things. I keep walking, but Meat Boy stops me with a bump to my shoulder. There's a crowd now. Justin and Gabriel are here too, just behind the throng of football players, all in the middle of the parking lot.
Hold on a second, Meat Boy says.
And the crowd moves around him to form a semicircle. I don't know how they do it. No one says, gather round, or you, stand here. It just happens organically. Like they can smell something is about to happen and want front row seats.
You haven't been excused.
Do we really have to do this? I ask, annoyed, because it is 7:59 and I haven't allotted for this pit stop. I will be late. I don't like being late. I will also have to find a way to walk through this crowd, and I hate crowds. They feel like putting on a turtleneck or a shirt with a collar, both of which are barbaric inventions.
Say it. Say, may I be excused?
I look up at him, confused. Why should I ask to be excused? I don't need a hall pass to go inside the school. He is not a teacher. We are of equal authority here. Oh. The feeling comes before the understanding. Something sneaks its way into my body, weaves its way around my intestines. I recognize this cold ache. This is what all of middle school felt like. I want nothing more than to put on my headphones, walk inside, and get back on track. Forget this delay. Wipe this encounter away with an eraser. And then I see Kit and her two friends, whose names I always forget and who I think of as cinched and hippie. They join the crowd, curious to see what's going on.
Hey, Tard! Say, may I be excused? Come on now, you can do it.
Leave him alone, Kit says, and my stomach clenches. A sharp cramp that feels like someone kicked me in the gut.
Sweet. Sticking up for your boyfriend,
Meat Boy says, which gives me a quick frisson of pleasure. He referred to me as Kit's boyfriend. Her boyfriend. But then I see Kit's face, which has closed, like that day I told her she was a good driver, and now I want to kill Meat Boy. Kit looks happier with her face open.
Get out of my way, I say. Your girlfriend is a fine piece of ass, huh?
I know from Miney that calling a girl a fine piece of ass is not respectful, maybe because it falls under the subcategory of the no talking about a girl's weight rule. I look over to Kit, but of course I can't read her expression. Is she telling me to fight for her? To run?
Stop it now. This is your first warning, I say, just like I learned from the Kung Fu video.
I am giving my opponent a fair chance to walk away. Peaceful resolution is always preferable to fighting. My body is humming. I could hurt them if I wanted to. And then, suddenly, I want to. Meat Boy is laughing. The whole line of them are laughing at me. I flash back to seventh grade, being stuck in a locker with my hair full of toilet water and feeling the cold drops slip down my back in slimy chunks. That smell. I think about all those texts, how I've been treated as less than for as long as I can remember. Why is being like them the baseline?
Last chance, I warn, and take a step forward, hoping that they will break apart and make room for me to pass.
They don't. Today, I will veer from my routine. Break out of my comfort zone, as Miney likes to say. I will do what needs to be done. Take one for the team, as the expression goes. There will be no getting back on track. Though for just a second, before it all starts, I close my eyes and picture myself in school, rounding the corner of the hallway just as Mozart hits D minor. And then, as I hear that perfect note in my mind, I open my eyes and step forward one more time. I drop kick Meat Boy. I sit in the principal's office with a bag of ice on my face that smells like cafeteria food. Not one food in particular, but instead a sickening amalgamation of all the food that they serve in there. Chicken nuggets and French fries and boiled broccoli, an undertone of meatloaf. My nose is bruised, but other than that, I am fine. I can't say the same about the football team. What are we going to do with you?